They're Grisha. They are potential threats to Fjerda, and you have no right to interfere.
Prisoners,
the man in the red cap repeated, his face troubled.
Grisha.
The crowd moved forward to stare at the women and girls. Nina knew the power of the prejudice they carried with them. She'd seen it in Matthias, felt the weight of it. But she'd also seen that burden shift, that seemingly immovable rock eroded by understanding. If that could happen for a Druskella soldier who had been raised to hate her kind, she had to believe it could happen for these people too. The girls in this wagon were not powerful witches raining down destruction. These were not faceless enemy soldiers. They were Fjerdan girls, plucked from their lives and tortured. If ordinary people could not see the difference, there was no hope for anyone.
Scylla,
said a young fisherman pushing forward through the crowd.
Scylla, is that you?
A frail, sallow-skinned girl opened her eyes.
Liv?
She said weakly.
Scylla,
he said, tears filling his eyes as he climbed up into the wagon, his head banging the ceiling.
Scylla, I thought you were dead.
He knelt, gathering her up in his arms.
Get down from there immediately, commanded the guard. What did you do to her?
The young fisherman cried, his cheeks wet, his face nearly purple with rage.
She is Grisha, and a prisoner of the— She's my sister,
he roared.
Is that Idoni Algren?
The man in the red cap asked, craning his neck.
I thought she went to Jerholm to serve as a governess, said a woman.
Nina glanced up at the factory. How much time had elapsed?
Eleanor Berglund, she said. Petra Toft, Siv Engman. Janneke Fisker, Sylvie Winther.
Lena Askell.
They took Scylla,
cried the young fisherman.
They took all of them!
A shot rang out. The checkpoint guard stood holding his rifle in the air.
That is enough! You will clear the road or we will— Boom!
The first explosion rocked the mountain. All eyes turned to the factory.
That sounded a lot bigger than it was supposed to, said Leonie.
Boom!
Another blast, then another. Right on time.
Sweet gel,
the red-capped man said, pointing up toward the old fort.
The dam!
Oh, saints, said Leonie. Something's wrong. My proportions must have been off.
Another boom sounded, followed by a terrifying roar. All of a sudden, people were screaming and running down the hill. The young fisherman took his sister in his arms and leapt from the back of the wagon.
We have to get out of here, he yelled. There's no time,
said the man with the red cap. Nina and Leonie clambered out of the back of the wagon. High above, dark columns of smoke rose from the flames at the factory. But far more frightening was the wall of water rushing toward them. The dam had shattered, and a snarling wave frothed and foamed down the mountain, uprooting trees and crushing everything in its path.
Maybe it will lose momentum,
said the fisherman, hugging his sister close.
Move,
shouted Leonie.
That water is loaded with poison. Anyone it touches is done for.
The guilt and fear on her face hurt Nina's heart. But this was the way it had to be. Fjerda didn't need mercy. It needed miracles.
We did this, said Hanna. We have to stop it.
Some of the townspeople were scrambling up the hillsides, but the wave was coming too fast.
Get behind me,
Adric yelled at the crowd.
Now!
Nina commanded in Fjerdan when the people hesitated.
Leonie,
Adric said as the people crowded in, forming a wedge behind him.
Can you do it?
She nodded, determined, touched her fingers to the jewels in her hair, lips moving in a whispered prayer. Nina could hear Leonie's warning in her head. Poisons are tricky work. The wave thundered toward them, churning with foam and bits of debris, so tall and wide it seemed to block out the sun.
Get ready!
Adric cried. Leonie spread her arms. Adric thrust his hand forward, and the wave split, cleaved by the force of the gust he summoned, passing around the townspeople in an angry flood. As the water passed, Leonie raised her hands, and Nina saw a yellowy cloud appear in the air around her. She was drawing the poison from the water.
Grisha.
Nina heard the word rise from the crowd.
Thrusion.
Witches. The cloud of poison grew above them as the water tumbled on and on. At last the tide had exhausted itself, but Leonie continued to draw the poison out until the flood had slowed to a trickle. She stood with arms raised in the sudden silence, as the crowd stared upward at the lethal mass of muddy yellow powder hovering over their heads.
Pastila! They cried out. Morden!
Poison. Death. No, Nina murmured to herself. Opportunity. She reached into the waters of the flood, seeking the materials she needed, her power touching on the bones of girls lost in the dark. She grabbed hold. Leonie's arms were shaking, her lips pulled back in a grimace. Adric whirled, focusing the wind, forming it into a tiny cyclone, gathering the poison and driving it into the empty guardhouse. With a twist of his wrist, the door slammed shut. He grabbed Leonie up against him before she could collapse. In the new quiet, Nina could hear the babies wailing, people crying. She didn't know how much damage the water might have done to the buildings below. The crowd was staring at Adric and Leonie. The soldiers raised their rifles. Nina prepared to call the corpses from the factory to protect them, but she hoped. She hoped.
Look, cried the man in the red cap.
In the wake of the water, a great ash tree stood in the center of the road, its white branches stretching to the sky, its thick roots sprawling in the mud.
Jell and all his waters, said the man from the tavern, beginning to weep. It's made of bone.
The bones of the girls lost to the mountain, forged by Nina's power into something new.
Praise Jell,
said the young fisherman, and fell to his knees. Nina was glad now that she could not hear Matthias's voice, that he could not witness the way she had used his god. The trick she'd pulled wasn't the act of a soldier with honor, it was a bit of theater, the low illusion of con men and thieves. But she was not sorry. The work she and Adric and Leonie had been doing, the work of the Hringsa, was not enough. No matter how many Grisha they saved, there would always be more they could not. There would always be Fjerda with its tanks and its pyres, and men like Jarl Broom to light the match. Unless Nina found a way to change it all.
Lay down your arms,
said the man in the red cap as the village of Gafala went to its knees.
We have seen miracles today.
Praise Jell, shouted Nina. She knelt before Adric and Leonie in her spring maiden pinafore.
And praise the new saints!
Chapter 34. Zoya. Zoya sped across the sands, praying she was not too late. She had once thought only a Grisha in the grip of Perem could fly. Now she arrived on the storm, borne aloft by thunderheads. It was almost as if she could feel Juris beneath her. The sight that greeted her was horrifying. Grigori had spread himself over the thornwood in a great dome, built and rebuilt of sinew, trying to keep Elisaveta and Yuri away from Nikolai and his shadow self. Zoya saw Elisaveta's thorns stabbing through Grigori's flesh, her stalks writhing like serpents, lashing out to puncture him again and again. But when the bodymaker began to scream, Zoya realized it was not the thorns that had undone him, but the insects Elisaveta had set upon his body. Tiny holes and furrows began to appear on his flesh as burrowing insects consumed him. His body broke apart, trying to escape itself. He shook and trembled, and then opened 1,000 mouths to cry out as he was devoured. Yuri stood behind Elisaveta, like a child hiding behind his mother's skirts, his hands pressed to his lips as if to stifle his own terror. Stupid boy. Had he known what Elisaveta intended to unleash? Had his starless saint promised him less bloodshed, or did a fanatic not care? The bodymaker shuddered and collapsed. Elisaveta gave a shout of triumph and descended upon the pinned bodies of Nikolai and the shadow creature, both of them now held in place by the vines of the thornwood. Zoya took 2 broken pieces of obsidian from her sleeve and cracked them together. The spark was all she needed. A gout of flame roared toward Elisaveta, who reared back in surprise. Then the saint's lips quirked in amusement. I thought you were wise enough to run, Zoya. You're too late. The Darkling's spirit will soon re-enter his body. There's no reason for you to be a casualty of this battle.
My king lies bleeding. I am his subject and his soldier, and I come to fight for him.
You are Grisha, Zoya Nazielenski. You need to be subject to no one and nothing.
Zoya could feel the pull of power even now. It would always be with her, this hunger for more. But she had made the acquaintance of tyrants before.
Subject to no one but you, the Darkling.
Elisaveta laughed.
We will not be rulers. We will be gods. If it's a crown you want, take it. Sit the Ravkin throne. We will hold dominion over the world.
I saw his body on the pyre. I watched him burn.
I stole him from the sands of the fold and left a facsimile in his place. It was well within my power.
Just as Zoya had suspected, and she didn't care about the particulars. But she wanted to keep Elisaveta talking.
You preserved his body?
In the hopes that he might be resurrected. I stored him in my hives. Yes, I know you are ready to believe my little story about my wound, my weariness. But you didn't dare walk down that dark corridor, did you? No one wants to look too closely at another person's pain. Did you really believe I would sacrifice an age of knowledge and power to become a mortal?
Would you, Zoya?
No, never. But the power she was tied to now did not need to be seized or stolen.
And what will you do with the world once you possess it?
Is this where I present my grand vision for peace, for a unified empire without border or flag?
Elisaveta shrugged.
I could make that speech. Perhaps the Starless One will make that our endeavor. I know only that I want to be free, and that I want to feel my power once more.
It was a need Zoya understood, and she knew the questions to ask. The same questions she had posed to herself when the dark crept in.
You don't have enough of it,
Zoya asked, moving slowly around the circle of the wood. The shadow creature's chest no longer glowed, so someone had managed to remove the thorn. Its shape was leaching slowly into the Darkling's supine body. Nikolai lay dying, impaled on the thicket, as his blood drained into the soil.
What is power? Without someone to wield it over. I have lived in isolated splendor for too many lifetimes. What is it to be a god without worship, a queen without subjects? I was the witch in the wood, the queen on her throne, the goddess in her temple. I will be once more. I will savor fear and desire and awe again.
You'll get none from me, said Zoya.
She raised her hands and her sleeves fell back. Black scales glittered in the twilight. Elisaveta gave a beleaguered sigh.
I should have known Joris would hold on long enough to do something noble and misguided. Well, old friend, she said. It will not matter.
With a sweep of her arm, two iron-colored stalks shot toward Zoya, their thorns gleaming like the barbed tail of a sea creature. Zoya drove her hands upward, and a ferocious whirlwind caught the stalks, twisting them around each other and yanking them from the thornwood by the root. Zoya flung them back at Elisaveta.
How fierce you are, said the saint. Joris was right to make you his student. I'm sorry his knowledge will die with you.
This time, half the wood seemed to rise up, a snarling mass of fat, thorny stalks. Zoya pulled moisture from the air in a cold wave, coating the stalks in frost, freezing their sap from the inside out. With a rumbling gust of air, she shattered them on the wind.
Such power. But you cannot defeat me, Zoya.
I have the advantage of eternity.
I'll settle for the advantage of surprise.
Zoya raised the sands for cover and let herself plummet in a flash to the thornwood.
As Elisaveta had talked, Zoya had drifted to the far side of the circle, to the bier on which the Darkling's perfectly preserved body rested. She had the briefest moment to take in the beautiful face, those elegant hands. Zoya had loved him with all the greedy, worshipful need in her girlish heart. She had believed he prized her, that he cared for her. She would have done anything for him, fought and died for him, and he had known that. He had cultivated it, as he had cultivated his own mystery, as he had nurtured Alina Starkov's loneliness and Jenya's desire to belong. He used us all, just as he is using Elisaveta now, and I let it happen. She would not let it happen again. She lifted her arms. "No," cried Elisaveta. "Burn as you were meant to," Zoya whispered. She thrust her arm down, and as easily as if she were summoning a soft breeze, lightning flowed in a precise, ear-splitting crack. It struck the bier in a blaze of sparks and blooming flame. Zoya saw a shadow emerge from the fire, as if trying to flee the heat. "What have you done?" Elisaveta screamed. She hurtled at the Darkling as the Thornwood tried to lift him to safety, away from the blaze. But Zoya focused the heat of her flames until they burned blue as Juris's dragon fire. The Thornwood began to collapse in on itself. Stalks twisted around Zoya's ankles, but she gathered her sparks and burned them away, singeing herself in the process. Fire was going to take some practice. Elisaveta had thrown herself on the pyre to try to retrieve what was left of the Darkling's body. Zoya knew that though the flames might cause Elisaveta pain, they would not stop her. Only Elisaveta's own power turned against her would be enough to end Agresha that ancient. Zoya had just a few minutes to act. She found Yuri running from the flames and snatched the glowing thorn from his hand. "I'll deal with you later," she snarled, swiping two dunes to surround him in a strong gust. They buried him to the neck. The remnants of the shadow creature hovered between Nikolai and the blaze of the Darkling's bier as if unsure. It was barely visible now, its wings shredded, its clawed hands hanging limply by its sides. She drove the glowing thorn back into the place where its heart should be. Nikolai came to consciousness with a gasp. "Take it out of me," he rasped, ducking his head toward his chest where the real thorn was lodged. "End him." "And what if I end you too?" There was no time to hesitate. Zoya yanked free the thorn. Nikolai howled as black blood poured from his chest. Zoya was slammed backward by the lashing trunk of a tree. All around her, the thornwood burst into bloom as Elisaveta rose, shrieking from the Darkling's final funeral pyre. She was a swarm of bees. She was a meadow in blossom. She was a woman mad with grief. The thornwood twisted around Zoya's wrists, binding her tight as Elisaveta hurtled toward her, locusts streaming from her mouth. Her hands extended, reaching for Zoya's throat. "It's all right," Zoya thought. "I saved Nikolai. I kept Elisaveta confined to the fold." She had stopped the Darkling at last. Let Elisaveta take her heart. But Juris's voice roared within her, and she could almost see his sneer.
"I gave up my scales for this. We are the dragon. We do not lie down to die."
Zoya felt the branches squeeze tighter. The thornwood was Elisaveta's creation. But the sap within it flowed like blood, like a river moved by tides. Elisaveta screamed her rage, and the buzz of insects filled Zoya's ears. Zoya focused on the sap running through the branches of the thornwood, the sap that had drowned her again and again. And she pulled. The stalks turned, the vicious spikes of their thorns jutting toward Elisaveta too quickly for her to change course or shift form. Her body struck the lances of the thorns with a dull, wet thud. She hung, bare inches from Zoya, impaled on the claws of her own creation. Zoya twisted the thorns and watched the light vanish from Elisaveta's eyes. She could have sworn she heard the dragon snarl his approval. Ravka might fall. The Grisha and the Second Army might scatter. But the world would be safe from Elisaveta and the Starless One. She thought of the cubs in the snow, of Liliana shelling hazelnuts by the fire. of the Hall of the Golden Dome back at the little palace, crowded with Grisha, laughter echoing off its walls before the Darkling attacked. She thought of Nikolai facing the demon, the thorn like a dagger in his hands.
This time I saved you, she thought as she collapsed. This time, I got it right.
Chapter 35 Nina. It wouldn't be safe for the Grisha women and their children, or for Adric and Leonie to remain in Gafala, no matter how the townspeople felt. The surviving soldiers of the factory would rally. Troops would be sent to impose order in the aftermath of the disaster. They all had to be gone before then. In the chaos, Hannah returned to the convent to restore her features and change back into her pinafore, pretending to be just as startled as the others at the terrors visited upon the town. No one could find the Well Mother, so it was easy for Hannah to slip away once more and return to the crossroads, where she found Nina instructing a young fisherman who had agreed to drive the wagon to port. Nina had known this reckoning was coming, and as soon as the fisherman had gone to see his sister, resettled in the wagon, she turned to face Hannah's anger. But Hannah was calm. Her voice was steady.
I haven't been asking the right questions, have I? I asked what you were, not who.
Nina had changed back into one of Mila's dresses. She smoothed her hands over the heavy skirts.
I think you know. Nina Zenik.
Hannah's copper eyes were hard.
The girl who maimed my father. The corpse witch.
Is that what the Fjerdans are calling me now?
Among other things.
I am an agent working for the Ravkin government. I came to this country to free people like you. People with Grisha power living in fear.
Why didn't my father recognize you?
Hannah asked. I was tailored before I came here. This, Nina said, gesturing to herself, isn't me.
Is anything about you real?
The skills I taught you. Everything I told you about the way this country works, about the corruption at its core. Nina took a breath and tapped her hand to her heart.
This is real, Hannah.
Hannah looked away.
You used me.
I did, said Nina. I won't deny it. Hannah's gaze swung back to Nina. She folded her arms.
You're not sorry, are you?
I'm sorry for the hurt I caused. I'm sorry to have lost your trust. But we are soldiers, Hannah. Warriors born. And we do what has to be done. There were lives at stake. There still are. I don't believe this is the only place where your father's men are experimenting on Grisha. Hannah swallowed, and Nina knew she was remembering the girls in their beds on the ward. The babies in the cribs, their suffering.
There are more?
More bases, more factories, more laboratories. I won't pretend that all Grisha are good or all Ravkans. They aren't. Maybe I'm not. All I know is that what your father and his men are doing is wrong. They have to be stopped. She laid her hand on Hannah's shoulder, afraid she might pull away.
We could stop them.
Hannah looked up at the factory, at the wagon full of prisoners, at the great ash towering over the road with its finger-bone branches. She ran a hand over her shorn scalp, the stubborn lines of her face more pronounced without the thick cloud of her hair to soften them. When her gaze returned to Nina, there was new fire in her eyes.
Save them all, she said.
Despite the sorrows and dangers of the day, despite the challenges that lay ahead, Nina felt a new lightness overtake her. Save them all.
But Nina, Hannah said, no more lies.
No more lies, she agreed. And Nina wished with all her heart that could be true.
What do we do first? Asked Hannah.
We see to your father.
I won't kill him.
Nina felt a smile curling her lips.
That is the very last thing I'd have you do.
When Hannah had gone to drag the still unconscious broom up the hill into the woods, Adric had turned to Nina.
No more lies, he said.
Eavesdropping, Atric? She looked over his shoulder. Is Leonie in the wagon? Is she all right?
She is, no thanks to you. Leonie didn't make a mistake with the fuses. You caused that accident, he said. You rigged those explosions to blow the dam. You put me and Leonie and countless innocent civilians at risk.
It was true. She'd done a contemptible thing. So where was her regret? Do you know what I learned in Ketterdam? Nina asked, gazing at the tree of bones she had built. No one is innocent. You turned the tide today, Adric. You didn't just hold back the waters. You changed the way these people see Grisha. You performed a miracle.
It wasn't a miracle. It was skill and luck and a fancy prop you built out of body parts.
Nina shrugged. The Fjerdans won't accept us as people, so maybe it's time they saw us as saints. And this is how we'll do it. Town by town, miracle by miracle. They're already whispering your name here, just as they whisper Sancta Alina's name. I guarantee tomorrow, there will be shrines dedicated to you all along this road. She raised a brow. You might not like what they're calling you, though.
I don't like any of this, he said.
But then his curiosity got the better of him.
Tell me.
Sancta Leonie of the Waters.
She paused. And Sanct Adric the Uneven. Adric rolled his eyes.
We need to go, Nina. Time is short.
There's something else, said Nina,
though she knew Adric would never forgive what she told him next.
I didn't share all of the information in Broom's letter.
Adric went very still.
What have you done, Nina?
There was talk of an assassination plot against the king.
By the Fjerdans.
It wasn't clear. It only said that Lansoff wouldn't be a problem for someone named Demidov. That their spies believed the situation would resolve itself without interference soon.
Adric cursed.
We have to get to Hjar as soon as possible. How could you keep a threat to the king's life to yourself?
What difference could it make? There were always threats to the king's life. Nikolai had Tolia and Tamar to watch over him, and Adric would have insisted on calling off the plan so they could travel to Hjar and locate a member of the network with access to a flyer who could get word to the capital. The king of Ravka had plenty of people to protect him. The girls on the mountaintop had only Nina.
It was one day lost, she said. There's time to get word to the king.
That was not your call to make. But I won't debate it with you now. You can answer for what you've done back in Ravka.
I'm not going with you.
Nina.
I know what I need to do, Adric. And I won't get a chance like this again. Ravka made me a soldier. Ketterdam made me a spy. Hana can help me become something else entirely.
Nina, you can't mean to.
I do.
We'll have no way to reach you there. You'll be without allies. Without resources. If things go wrong, you won't have any way out.
Nina glanced up at the smoldering wreckage of the factory.
Then I'll just have to blow a hole in the wall.
Chapter 36. Nikolai. The thornwood was bleeding. The sap that flowed from its trunks was no longer gold, but red, as if with Elisaveta's death it had died too. Its stalks began to shrivel, its thorns wilting. Nikolai pulled himself free, and the blood from his hands and legs dripped onto the sand. His chest throbbed, and yet the only sign that he'd driven a spike through it was a star-shaped scar. One more to add to his collection. In the distance, he could see the great palace crumbling, its spires collapsing.
What will be left?
He wondered. And how were he and Zoya going to get free of this place? He stumbled over to her. She lay on a wilted bed of thorn trees and red quince blossoms. Her hair splayed around her face. Before her, a dark pile of dead bees was heaped amid the branches.
Sancta Elisaveta.
Only a few feet away, he saw a mound of bones, both bare and human, blowing away to ash. Would this whole world crumble to dust? He knelt beside Zoya and checked her pulse. It was steady. He was surprised to see two fetters of black scales at her wrists.
Zoya,
he said, shaking her gently.
Commander Nazielensky.
Her lashes fluttered and she looked up at him. Nikolai reared back. For a moment he thought he'd seen.
No, that was impossible.
Zoya gazed at him with vibrant blue eyes.
Are you all right?
He asked.
Fine,
she replied.
You're sure?
Which one of us gets to kill the monk?
You're fine.
He helped her to her feet and they made their way to where Yuri lay buried up to his neck in sand. At some point, the rat had fainted. Blood trickled from his nose.
Nikolai sighed. I hate to say it, but we're going to have to let him live. I need all the information we can garner on the cult of the Starless and how the saints brought us here. I think it may have been Elisaveta who unlocked my chains the night I got free from the palace.
How?
She said their power could extend beyond the fold, but only where the people's faith was strongest. Yuri was at the palace that night. Maybe Elisaveta used him to send her vines or her insects past my guards.
Zoya snorted.
You're the one who invited him in. You can choose our next dinner guest. I want answers, so the monk lives. For now.
Perhaps some light torture then.
Or you could just let me kick him in the head for the next hour. I'd like nothing better, but I'm not feeling my best. And I'd prefer not to die in these clothes. We need to see if we can find our way out of here.
Zoya pulled the dunes away from Yuri and they dragged him onto his back. They bound his hands with strips of fabric from Zoya's kefta and gagged him for good measure.
Nikolai,
Zoya said, laying a hand on his arm as she summoned a pallet of air on which to carry the monk.
Did it work, at least? Are you free?
Nikolai winked at her.
As free as I'll ever be.
He didn't have the heart to tell her he could still feel the monster somewhere inside him. Weakened, licking its wounds, but waiting for the opportunity to rise again. Whatever power had bound them in permanent twilight had died with the saints. Nikolai and Zoya had begun walking less than an hour when they saw the first twinkle of stars. They continued on, despite their wounds and their fatigue, until at last they saw lights in the distance, and eventually the dead gray sands of the fold gave way to soft meadow. Though Nikolai would have liked nothing better than to foist himself on the hospitality of a farmer, they couldn't risk discovery. They took shelter in an old equipment shed. It was damp and uncomfortable, but it was either that or rest beneath the branches of a plum orchard, and Nikolai had no desire to be anywhere near a tree. It was a pleasure to close his eyes and feel sleep fall over him. He would never take it for granted again. Zoya set out before dawn for Krybirsk and returned more quickly than expected with horses, a pack full of traveling clothes, and a young Grisha healer to see to Nikolai's wounds.
I'm sorry, Your Highness,
the boy apologized as he sealed the punctures in Nikolai's hands.
This will most likely leave a scar. I'm still training.
A roguish scar? Asked Nikolai.
Well, a deep one? Just as good.
When he was done, Zoya sent him on his way.
Speak of this to anyone, and I will consider it treason.
She trained her hard gaze on the boy and said,
That is a hanging offense.
He stumbled backward through the doorway.
Yes, Commander. Of course, Commander.
Zoya frowned and shook her head.
I swear they come through training softer and softer. One little glare and he was about to call for smelling salts.
Nikolai said nothing. This time there had been no mistaking it. When Zoya had glared at the boy, her eyes had flashed silver, and her pupils had turned to slits.
For a moment, he had been looking into the eyes of the dragon. Just what had Zoya done to get them free?
That question would have to wait until they were safely back at the palace. They pushed through their exhaustion and rode hard the rest of the day. Occasionally, Nikolai felt a jab in his chest, as if the thorn were still lodged there. Yuri sat silent and shivering in his bindings, his hood pulled low over his face. They soon learned that Whatever had happened on the Unsea had been felt throughout Ravka, maybe beyond. Earthquakes had been reported as far north as Ulensk and as far south as Dvostolba. Nikolai knew there would be other consequences. Three of the world's most powerful Grisha had died. And the ritual had definitely not gone as planned. Before they entered Os Alta, Zoya bound Nikolai's hands and attached ropes to the bridles of his and Yuri's horses so they would both look like prisoners as she led them through the lower town, across the great canal, and onto the broad boulevards that would take them up the gentle slope and through the golden gates to the palace. They saw no mourning banners, no flags flown at half-mast, no one was rioting in the streets. Either Nikolai was decidedly less popular than he'd hoped, or somehow Jenya and David had managed to keep his disappearance a secret. Nikolai felt torn between anticipation and dread. When Zoya had gone to Krybirsk, he'd ungagged the monk and had quickly understood that as bad as things were, they were going to get much worse. Open the door. He'd done it, and something terrible had stepped through. And yet, at his first glimpse of the crowned double eagle perched atop the gates and the gilded rooftop of the grand palace in the distance, his heart lifted. He was home. He had survived, and even if he wasn't cured, somehow he and Zoya and the others would find a way to move forward. The demon inside knew him well, but now Nikolai knew the demon too. Zoya rode up to the guards on duty, tossed back her hood, and said, "Open for your commander." The guards instantly came to attention. "Moi sovereigni! I am weary and I have prisoners to present to the other members of the triumvirate. Do they have papers?" "I will take responsibility for them, but if you make me wait any longer for a hot bath, I will also take responsibility for your slow death." The guard cleared his throat and bowed. "Welcome home, commander." The gates swung open. It was clear some kind of big party was in progress. The walkways were lit with lanterns, and music floated down from the sparkling windows of the Grand Palace. "Is it possible they actually went through with it all?" Zoya said in disbelief. "How can you throw a ball for a king who isn't here?" Nikolai asked. "They couldn't possibly have attempted to tailor someone to take his place, could they? And there would have been no time to train him, especially for an event with so much riding on it." "Maybe they dressed up a scarecrow and put your crown on its head," said Zoya. "I should adopt that strategy at council meetings." They weren't sure what might be waiting for them inside, so they checked the monk's bindings and gave him a drop of Jenya's sleep concoction for good measure. They stashed him behind a hedge and agreed to split up until they found a member of the triumvirate, or someone they could speak to without causing an uproar. Nikolai made his way along the southern flank of the palace, keeping to the shadows as music drifted back to him from the party inside. He glimpsed movement in the conservatory. A couple meeting for an assignation? He'd leave them to it. He hastened along the glass wall dotted with miniature orange trees, and was about to turn the corner when he saw himself. A bolt of panic shook him, his mind racing with confused thoughts. What if he wasn't Nikolai anymore? What if he was just the monster? What if he was still caught in the Twilight Fold and this was all a dream? He looked down at his hands, scarred but human, without claws. "I am Nikolai Lansov. I am here. I am home." He looked back through the glass. The other him was standing amid the fruit trees and fountains of the conservatory, medals glinting from the pale blue sash across his chest. So this was why there was no panic in the countryside or cities, no flags of mourning raised. They'd used his plan. Jenya had tailored some poor sap to play the role of the king. Nikolai was at once thrilled and insulted to think that someone could take his place so easily. Well, a lesser man might have found it humbling. And yet his mind couldn't help but spool out the possibilities. He could have this actor sit through state dinners and the openings of orphanages and concert halls. Nikolai could be in two places at once. But what was his new twin doing away from the other guests? The answer presented itself in an elaborate green gown and emeralds. A girl. A very pretty girl in what appeared to be very expensive jewels. Was this the princess, Eri Kir Taban? There were no chaperones in sight. His stand-in was pacing, talking rapidly. Nikolai couldn't hear what he was saying, but to his great horror it looked very much like a declaration of love. What was this pretender getting them into? And had Jenya and David sanctioned such a thing? This was the moment for a well-timed interruption. But exactly how was Nikolai supposed to accomplish that without upending the whole charade?
Maybe I'm wrong and they're discussing matters of state, Nikolai thought hopefully.
At that moment, the couple strode toward each other. The false king of Ravka took the princess in his arms. She tilted her face up to his, her eyes sliding closed, her lips parted. That was when Nikolai saw the knife in her hands. Chapter 37. Isaac. Isaac's palms were damp. It had not been easy to evade Tolia and Tamar. The twins were seasoned mercenaries with a gift for appearing when they were least wanted. But at his first glimpse of Eri in the conservatory, he knew he would have gladly dodged 1,000 trained soldiers to be here right now. He had no idea how she had lost her guards or how much time he would have with her before they were discovered. He only knew he wanted to look at her forever. Her gown was the color of green pears, its elaborate folds embroidered with falcons. Emerald combs glittered in the dark fall of her hair. Nikolai? She asked, peering into the dimly lit conservatory. Isaac, he wanted to beg her to say. What would it be like to hear her call him by his real name? I'm here, he whispered. She turned and smiled, and it was like a fist to his chest.
I wasn't sure you'd come.
I wasn't sure I'd be able to. My ladies have been fussing over me since sunrise. I didn't think I'd find a second alone to escape them.
I'm glad you did.
That was an absurd understatement, but he couldn't think of anything else to say. She took a step toward him, and without thinking, he took a step back, maintaining the distance between them. He saw the hurt on her face, and felt like the worst kind of dolt.
I'm sorry, he said quickly,
though he knew apologies did not come easily to kings. She clasped her hands in front of her. Did I misunderstand?
No, he said. No, but there's something I need to tell you.
Isaac turned on his heel, pacing in front of the orange trees, their sweet-smelling blossoms clouding the air. He had planned countless things to say, but none of them seemed right in this moment. He was a poor boy from a small town. He was a palace guard. He'd thought he was happy. He had been happy until all this began. But now? Isaac wished he could take her in his arms and kiss her. But he couldn't do that when every word he'd spoken to her was a lie, and yet he couldn't tell her the truth. Not when he might put an entire nation at risk.
Eri, he began. If I were not a king,
he faltered. What was he trying to ask her exactly? He tried again.
What is it you like about me?
She laughed, and his breath left his chest in a grateful rush at the sound. Is this a test, or does your pride just need stroking?
My pride is always in need of tender attention, he said.
Then cursed beneath his breath. That was Nikolai talking, and he did not want to be Nikolai tonight.
Wait, I'll tell you what I like about you. Your nerve. Your way with a practice sword. That you always say what you mean. The way you look when you tell stories of your house by the lake.
She tilted her head, and for a moment an expression of such sadness flashed across her face.
What is it? He said,
wanting only to wipe whatever had caused her pain from her mind.
Nothing, she said. Only that I wish this moment could last.
He wanted to tell her it could, but he didn't know if that was true. He could offer her nothing. And here was the sticky reality. He had no idea what the triumvirate truly wanted from him. Would they ask Isaac to play this role forever as they ran Ravka? He thought there was no way he could be the king they needed. But when he'd dined with Eri, he'd started to wonder if maybe, with her by his side, he could. Would Jenya and the others ever permit such a courtship? If they refused, would he have the courage to stand against them? And even worse, the thought that had kept him awake since that happy night on the island. What if the real king returned and chose Eri as his bride? Would Isaac have to watch him court and marry her? Would he stand at attention in the chapel at the royal wedding? Would Eri ever realize that the man she wed was not the man who had stood here in this conservatory on this night with his heart full of longing?
I wish it could last too, he said. I wish there was no one in the world but you and me, that there were no countries, no kings and queens.
He took a step closer, and then she was gliding into the circle of his arms. She was lithe, almost wiry. She was perfect.
Eri,
he said as he drew her to him, as she tilted her beautiful face to his invitation.
Could you love me if I was not a king?
I could, she said. And he didn't understand why her eyes were suddenly full of tears. I know I could.
What's wrong?
He cupped her cheek, brushing away the tears with his thumb. Nothing at all, she whispered. He felt a jolt, as if she'd shoved him and looked down. Something was sticking out of his chest. His mind made sense of the shape as the pain hit. A dagger. The white handle was carved with a wolf. He heard a furious rapping against the glass, as if a bird were trying to get into the conservatory.
Why?
He asked, as he slid to the ground. She fell with him, going to her knees, her tears flowing freely now. For my country, she said as she wept. For my brother. For my queen.
You don't understand,
he tried to say. A laugh emerged from his lips, but it sounded wrong, like a bubble popping. Forgive me, she said, and yanked the dagger from his body. Pain flooded through him as he felt the warm gush of blood from his wound. She pressed a soft kiss to his lips. My only comfort is that you never could have been mine. But know that I would have gladly been yours.
Eri,
he moaned as the world began to go dark. Not Eri. From somewhere he could hear shouting, the sound of hurried footfalls running toward them. Everyone mourns the first blossom, she recited softly. Who will weep for the rest that fall? Isaac watched, helpless, as she grasped the dagger and drove the blade into her own heart. Chapter 38 Nina Nina dressed with care. Her gown was palest lavender, modestly cut, perfectly suited to Mila Yanderstadt's coloring and generous figure. She wore no jewelry. What baubles could a poor widow afford? But a Fjärden woman's greatest adornment was her virtue. Nina smiled at the girl in the mirror, the expression sweet and guileless. She smoothed her flaxen hair into a tidy braided crown that would have made the well-mother proud and found her way to the solarium. The great glass windows were ringed with frost, and through them she could see the ice moat, and beyond it, the glittering spires of the White Island. The ice court was as dazzling as she remembered. She heard footsteps behind her and turned to see Jarl Broom approaching, his wife on his arm. They were a remarkably handsome couple, tall and fine-boned.
Anka Yanderstadt, he said warmly. My savior. Please allow me to introduce you to my wife, Ylva.
Nina curtsied. It is my greatest honor. Broom's wife took Nina's hand. Her thick chestnut hair fell nearly to her waist, and she wore a gown of gold silk that made her brown skin glow like autumn. Nina could see where Hannah had come by her beauty. The honor is mine, said Ylva. I understand my husband owes his life to you. Once the wagon was long gone, Nina and Hannah had awakened Broom. They'd told him that they'd come running after the explosion and found his body by the side of the road. He was lucky to have escaped the waters and the disaster at the factory with little more than a bad bump to the head. Whatever suspicions Broom had held regarding Mila Yonderstadt, they'd been cured by the fact that she had remained in Gafala when the Zemini couple and the Grisha prisoners had fled. Nina and Hannah had waited patiently at the convent while Broom had returned to the factory to see who had survived and put everything he could to rights, and, Nina suspected, to make sure there was no evidence of his failures. An industrial accident that had resulted in the deaths of valued captives was one thing, but a successful Grisha escape attempt after his humiliation at the ice court the previous year would have spelled disaster for his career. And it was very important to Nina that Jarl Broom did not lose his favored position in the Fjärden hierarchy. For the plan she had in mind, she would need every one of his connections, and every bit of his access to highly placed bureaucrats, military commanders, and noblemen.
"I did nothing," Nina said to Ylva. "It was Hannah who showed true courage."
"And that is another debt we owe you," Ylva said. "Jarl tells me you are responsible for the remarkable change in our daughter."
"I cannot take praise for that. I credit your own influence and the steady tutelage of the Wellmother. May Jell watch over her."
The Brooms nodded solemnly. Then Ylva's face broke into a wide smile.
"Hannah!"
she exclaimed as her daughter entered the room.
The truth was that Nina deserved plenty of credit for Hannah's transformation. She'd taught her to dress to suit her long, lean figure, taught her to stand with her shoulders back and walk with a lady's grace. And of course, Nina had taught her to act. As for Hannah's trust, she would find a way to earn it, and maybe even be worthy of it. Somehow.
Ylva embraced her daughter as Broom said to Nina,
"Hannah tells me she is at last prepared to put aside her foolish ways and find a husband. I do not know what magic you worked on her, but I am grateful. She is so much changed."
"She was perfect before," thought Nina. "Or would have been if you hadn't pruned and plucked at her like an overeager gardener trying to mold an unruly shrub." Nina smiled.
"I think it was only a matter of time before Hannah discovered who she was truly meant to be."
"You must learn to take a compliment, Mila."
He pressed a kiss to her knuckles.
"I hope you will in time."
He clapped his hands together.
"Shall we dine?"
Hannah turned to her father, her face happy and serene. She wore deepest russet, and her freckles looked like pollen on her cheeks. Her hair was still closely shorn.
"I'm afraid a number of generals have come to discuss boring matters of war. Vadik Demidov himself will be arriving in the capital soon," said Broom.
Nina hoped so. She intended to learn all she could about the Lansov pretender and Fierda's plans for battle.
"We will try not to put you ladies to sleep."
"We will be happy to talk amongst ourselves, Papa," said Hannah. "There are new dress designs from Gedrenga to discuss."
He smiled indulgently at her and took his wife's arm. As soon as his back was turned, Hannah winked at Nina, her gaze snapping fire.
"Shall we?"
she said. Nina slid her hand into Hannah's as they followed Ylva and Jarl Broom into dinner. They would build a new world together. But first, they had to burn the old one down. Chapter 39 Zoya. Zoya heard the uproar and ran toward it. She'd sensed the wrongness of the night even before she heard Tolia shout. She felt it on the air, as if the crackle of lightning she controlled so easily now was everywhere, in everything. It had been that way since she'd claimed Joris's scales. He was with her, all of his lives, all he had learned, the crimes he'd committed, the miracles he'd performed. His heart beat with her, the dragon's heart, and she could feel that rhythm linking her to everything. The making at the heart of the world. Had she really believed in it before? Maybe. But it hadn't mattered to her. Power had been protection. The getting of it. The honing of it. The only defense she could grasp against all the pain she had known. Now it was something more. Everything was different now. Her visions seemed sharper, as if light limned each object. She could smell the green grass outside, wood smoke on the air, even the marble. She'd never realized marble had a scent. In this moment, running down these familiar halls, toward the clamor in the conservatory, she didn't feel fear, only a sense of urgency to make some kind of order out of the trouble she knew she'd find. But she couldn't have anticipated the mess awaiting her. She closed the doors to the conservatory behind her and clouded the glass with mist in case of passers-by. Security had fallen to pieces without her here. No surprise. Tamar knelt beside a shoe girl with a dagger in her chest. Jenya was crying. Tolia, David, and Nikolai, still dressed in his prisoner's shroud, stood around another body. A corpse that looked very much like the king. Everyone was shouting at once. Zoya silenced them with a thunderclap. As one, the group turned to her, and instantly they had their hands up, ready to fight.
"How do we know it's really you?" said Jenya.
"It's really her," said Nikolai.
"How do we know it's really you?"
Tamar growled, not interrupting her work on the shoe girl. It seemed a hopeless cause. The girl still had color in her cheeks, but the dagger looked as if it had pierced her heart. Zoya refused to look more closely at the other body. It was too hard not to think of Nikolai pinned to the thornwood, his blood watering the sands of the fold.
"Jenya," said Zoya calmly, "I once got drunk and insisted you make me blonde."
"Intriguing," said Nikolai. "What were the results?"
"She looked gorgeous," said Jenya.
Zoya plucked a bit of dust from her sleeve.
"I looked cheap."
Jenya dropped her hands.
"Stand down, it's her."
Then she was hugging Zoya fiercely as Tolia clasped Nikolai in his massive arms and lifted him off his feet.
"Where the hell have you been?"
"It's a long story,"
said Nikolai, and demanded Tolia set him down. Zoya wanted to hold tight to Jenya, take in the flowery scent of her hair, ask her 1,000 questions. Instead, she stepped back and said,
"What's happened here?"
"The dagger is Fjordan," said Tolia.
"Maybe so," said Nikolai, "but it was wielded by a shoe girl."
"What do you mean?" said Tamar as she worked frantically to restore the girl's pulse. "She was attacked too."
"Is it her heart?" Zoya asked.
"No," said Tamar. "That would be beyond my skill. The dagger struck a little too far to the right."
"Can you save her?" asked Jenya.
"I don't know. I'm just trying to stabilize her. It will be up to our healers to do the rest."
"I saw it all happen," said Nikolai. "She attacked him. Me? Him? Then turned the blade on herself." "So the shoe are trying to frame Fjorda," said Tolia.
Jenya's tears began anew. She knelt and put her hand to the imposter's cheek.
"Isaac," she murmured.
"Who?"
said Zoya.
"Isaac Andreev,"
Nikolai said quietly, kneeling by the body.
"Private first class, son of a schoolteacher and a seamstress."
Tolia brushed his hand over his eyes.
"He didn't want any of this."
"Can you restore his features?" asked Nikolai.
"It's harder without blood flow," said Jenya. "But I can try."
"We owe that at least to his mother."
Nikolai shook his head.
"He survived the front. He was meant to be past harm."
Jenya bit back a sob.
We knew we were putting him in danger's way. We thought we were doing what was right."
"The princess is breathing," Tamar said. "I need to get her to the Korporalkai in the little palace."
"This makes no sense," said Jenya. "Why not just murder the king?
Or the man she believed was king? Why try to kill herself, too?
And why would a princess sacrifice herself to do the job?"
"She didn't," said Nikolai. "Get me fresh clothes. I'll return to the party to close out the festivities. I want to have a word with Hiram Schenk. He's the highest-ranking member of the Kirch Merchant Council here, yes?"
"Yes,"
said Jenya.
"But he isn't happy with you,"
He's about to be, for a time. Keep the doors to the conservatory locked and leave Isaac's body here.
We shouldn't, Tolia began, but Nikolai held up a hand.
Just for now, I swear he will have the burial he deserves. Bring the Shu delegation to me in my father's rooms in